Rod Illingworth, can you tell us something we don't know about Simon Yates?
I don't know them that well, but what I do remember was they must have been sort of schoolboy age or early junior age. I remember seeing them on Manchester track, doing track league. They both reminded me very much of Ben Swift, because Swifty was also, you know, a real little tiny guy, and the bike always looked too big for them. But what I do remember was, you know, they had that movement. You could see they clearly, like Swifty, didn't perhaps have the power about them, but they sort of, they had that movement and vision on the track. You could see something about them, you know. So when, you know, Simon went on then to be part of the academy team and world points race champion, I wasn't surprised. But I think that's what makes him quite unique to other GC riders, is he's, you know, he's got that speed, he's got that top end, and I think that's what will set him apart differently here. Is I think you may find a stage like today, he will win the group finish because he's got that top end where a lot of the GC guys don't have that. Quite unique, really, yeah.
Now, I wonder if I can tell you something. They're twin brothers.
Are they twins?
Well, yeah, but they're fraternal twins, not okay. Identical twins.
Okay, yeah, right, okay, didn't know that.
Do you know the difference?
Nope.
We might have to cut to our embryologist here.
Yes, here for you, Lionel. Identical, or monozygotic twins, develop from one egg, which splits to form two embryos, so the babies look the same. And fraternal, or dizygotic twins, develop from two different eggs, having two babies that look very much different.
Chris Hill Jensen, tell us something we don't know about Simon Yates.
Impossible question to ask me. He likes a good lion. He's typically the last to come down for breakfast.
Did you know that he likes video games and Indian food?
Indian food is a must with the Yates brothers, that's for sure. Adam and Simon have ticked off as many Indian restaurants as they possibly can in all the countries they've been in.
Have you ever been for a curry with them?
A bit afraid, actually. I don't think my bowels can handle it.
But George Bennett, tell me something I don't know about Simon Yates.
Last week he got back from a training ride about 8 p.m. in Andorra.
And you saw him, or he told you?
I was asleep. My girlfriend was going down shopping, and she said, I just saw Yatesy. And I looked at the time, it was about 7:30 or something, and he was going up about 2,500 meters of altitude. So he either does massive days or he starts late.
And did you know that he was a former points race world champion on the track?
Yatesy on what points race? I didn't, but it doesn't surprise me the way I saw him kick off on Aetna. You don't do that with an RPM of 80 like I've got. So,
Alex Dowsett, can you tell us anything we might not know about Simon Yates?
A little sod pipped me in a devil at track league once. I remember he was a junior, we were under 23s. I was riding a devil from the back, so trying to just make sure there's always someone behind me, and he popped round me at the last minute, put his bike in front of me on the line, looked at me and smiled. I was like, you little shit. Back then, didn't expect him to go down the climbing route because he was such a talent on the track.
Did you know that his first big road win was in the Tour of Britain in 2013 at Haytor in Exeter, or in Devon?
I did remember that because I was bringing up the rear in my usual gruppetto climbing position.
And he beat Quintana, I think, up that hill.
You've told me something I didn't know about that.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From Grand Tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Montevergine.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney and I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello, Lionel. Buonasera.
Buonasera. You just heard a few people talking about Simon Yates, who retained the pink jersey on stage 8 of the Giro d'Italia.
Learned anything? We learned a fair few things there, didn't we, Lionel?
We did. I was hoping to squeeze in another little fact about Simon Yates, and that is that
his favourite curry is a dupiazza. Is it? Or is he more of a Danzac kind of guy?
I'm not sure.
We'll find out before the end of the Giro.
I don't know. I think dupiazza. Danzac's quite sour. Yeah, he was born on August the 7th, 1992, which was the day before Lance Armstrong rode his first race as a professional, just to put it into context. Not that for those of us who remember Lance Armstrong riding his first race as a professional, the San Sebastian Classic in 1992, which came shortly after the Olympic Games, which was his last race as an amateur. He finished last in that San Sebastian in 92, came back the following year and won it. What an improvement in a year
what
that
a
was
huge
for,
improvement.
For the young lad. I wonder what became of him. Anyway, stage 8 of the Giro, Daniel. We'll just launch straight into the tale of the tappa. It was from Praia a Mare to Montevergine di Mercogliano. How was that?
Bad. It was bad. Montevergine Di Mercogliano.
Montevergine?
Yeah.
What did I say?
Montevergine, I don't know, but anyway. Plenty of time left. You're here for another week. Plenty of time to resurrect Lionel Learns Italian.
209 kilometres. It was shaped by a break of seven riders. Matteo Monteguti of AG2R, David Villela of Astana, Tosh van der Sander of Lotto Fix All, Kern Berman of Lotto NL Jumbo, Matej Mohoric of Bahrain Merida, Jan Polanch of which team, Bahrain Merida. Which team is Jan Polanch in?
UAE. Yeah. And we had a listener complaint last night. One of our more illustrious listeners is
all
Lionel.
Our listeners are illustrious.
They're
Daniel.
All illustrious, but is the Bahrain Merida team manager Lionel, not director sportive. You even called him sports director, which is even worse in my book. Team manager. Sorry, Brent.
Brent Copeland, that is, of Bahrain Merida.
Correct.
Team manager. Don't want to upset any Kiwis out there. I'm joking. Brent Copeland is South African. Maybe that should be the theme. Every corrections corner just commits another error. I don't know. Anyway, the seventh man in the break, Rodolfo Torres, who kept up Androni's 100% record of getting a rider in every break in this Giro. They were away for a long time with 35 kilometres to go. The gap was still looking fairly healthy, but of course they had to climb to Montevergine di Mercogliano.
That is much better. And a vast improvement. Similar to Lance Armstrong's improvement post the 1992 Classico de San Sebastian.
Well, as they approached the bottom of the climb, the rain started to come down. It wasn't as heavy for the riders as it was for us as we were driving across country to the finish. It was absolutely, well, torrential at times, wasn't it? It made driving very difficult. We thought if they had to ride through that, I think extreme weather protocol would have been invoked, surely, because you couldn't see. It was coming down so heavily. But the riders escaped the worst of that. With about 15 kilometres to go, van der Sander pushed on a bit. It was fractured a little bit, and they went away and came back together again. And then Bauman split the group with 12 kilometres to go. Monteguti went with him, and then two Slovenians, Mohoric and Polanc, made it a quartet. But the gap was coming down. Mitchelton Scott was setting a really good pace, mostly set by Jack Haig. There was a moment of slight drama in the final few kilometres. Chris Froome slipped and hit the deck going round a greasy right-hand bend. A lot of people have said they were looking forward to getting out of the south of Italy, hoping it wouldn't rain in the south of Italy. Makes the roads very slippery. Wout Poels and others waited for Froome, paced him back up. And then Sky was setting a really strong pace on the front. But really, the climb wasn't hard enough to do a great deal of damage overall. As you predicted, Daniel, it was a fairly tame.
I think this finish in Montevergine Mercogliano needs to be parked for a few years. Every time the race has gone up there, it's been a fairly tepid spectacle. Usually we've seen a bit of a sprint at the end, the sort of puncher, climber type riders winning. That didn't happen today, but there wasn't an awful lot of drama, was there?
No, well, there wasn't, but Bauman was looking really good until about a kilometre and a bit to go. And then we saw Richard Carapaz of Movistar, the best young rider in the race, 24-year-old Ecuadorian. Really impressive attack. Seized the moment, won the stage. First Ecuadorian rider to win a Grand Tour stage.
First Ecuadorian rider to ride the Giro.
And then we saw Thibaut Pinot go for second place. He got pipped by Davide Formolo, but still got a four-second time bonus. None of the big names lost any time. Simon Yates is still in pink. Pinot leaps over Pozzovivo from fifth to fourth, thanks to that time bonus. And Carapaz climbs from 11th to 8th overall. The points jersey is still with Viviani. The King of the Mountains is still Chavez. And the white jersey is still Carapaz. So it was all about Ecuador's first Grand Tour stage victory today, really, wasn't it? And Chris Froome's fall and his reaction and Team Sky's reaction to that.
Yeah, Carapaz has been touted as a future star of Grand Tours for a year or two now. He was picked up by Eusebio Unzue, the manager of Movistar, I think on a tip-off from Oscar Sevilla. Remember him, Lionel?
I do,
What was
yes.
he doing in 1992?
In 1992, I don't know, but in the 2000, he was doing quite a lot of doping, I think.
Let's move on. Yeah, Carapaz has had a good first couple of years at Movistar. Lives in a place called Julio Andrade in Ecuador. Got two children. I don't want to steal.
Where does he live?
In a place called Julio Andrade, which sounds like a shady sort of South American agent, rather than
I was gonna
the place
it
where
sounds like
a South
kind
American
of
lives.
Nightclub singer.
Yes, yes. Very much
singer
so.
With a limited range of tunes, but a lot of confidence.
I mean, everyone sort of raves about his maturity. I think we might know someone who knows Carapaz quite well. Do we not?
Let's hear from our young friend, Fran Reyes, who covers the Vuelta a España with us here on the Cycling Podcast. He phoned in a little dispatch.
Greetings from Spain, my dear buddies of the Cycling Podcast. This is your friend Fran Reyes, talking from Spain. I have been tempted for several days of sending you an audio note, and today I just can't help myself and I want to tell you how happy I am about the victory of Richard Carapaz today in Monte Vergine di Mercogliano. As you know, I have the press officer of Equipo Lizarte, which is Movistar's sort of feeder team, and we had him in our team back in 2016. We brought him on board because Eusebio Unzue got some kind of recommendation and asked us to take him. And it was a bit hard for him because it was his first spell in Europe, abroad, far from South America. And it was quite hard for him because he had already a son and a wife. He had to leave them behind in order to become a professional cyclist, but believe me, he did his best in order to take advantage of the opportunity. He did a super year, and above all, he surprised us every week by how mature he was. He has been jumping two steps at a time instead of one since he got to Spain, signed for Movistar, did a great year in 2017, and as for this year, well, you saw it with your eyes how powerful he is. He has this great skill of being pretty good at sustaining power, but also having a great acceleration, and he showed it today with that devastating attack who got him the victory. I'm enjoying your coverage of the Giro Italia. Please keep it going, Daniel, Lionel. You are a couple of stars, and the Buffalo as well.
So Fran Reyes could stake a claim to having discovered Carapaz, really, I guess, if he rode for his team or the team that he worked for. It struck me looking at the Movistar team coming here, obviously they are packing their Tour de France team with just about everybody they've got later on in the summer. And you looked at that list initially and thought, well, what are Movistar going to do here? And they're having off to a great opening week, stage win and a few days in the white jersey, and suddenly Carapaz could be certainly a top 10 contender. I mean, who knows how he'll go on the really big climbs, but you would imagine that he's not going to be, if he can cope with Etna and he can cope with today, he's not going to be bad, is he?
We need to find out how high Julio Andrade is. That again, if we're thinking of him as an Ecuadorian nightclub singer, that sounds bad. Is he high? But we need to know how high the place is. Is he from altitude? But that aside, whether it is or isn't, he does have decent pedigree as a climber, and he's very well placed now for the white jersey competition. There will be some challenges. We spoke to Ben O'Connor, didn't we, yesterday? He went pretty well again today. The Yates, well, there's only one Yates here, Simon Yates. He's got bigger fish to fry, and he's also no longer qualified for white jersey competition. So Carapaz might have a relatively clear run in that competition.
Yeah, just to recap how he's been getting on this season. Well, he won the Vuelta a Asturias in Spain the end of last month. He was third in the Settimana Coppi Bartoli stage race. A bit before that, he was 11th in Paris-Nice, a result that went below the radar a little bit. So he's been performing well all season.
Sorry, Lionel, can I correct myself? He won't have a clear run at that competition because Miguel Angel Lopez also still qualifies for that position. Superman Lopez. And he surely has to be the very, very hot favourite.
Probably hear a tractor in the background here. We are in the deepest countryside, aren't we, Agriturismo?
We're in the middle of the vineyards of the Sanio region, or Sanio, which is a sort of sub-region of Campania. Lionel's drinking, we're both drinking craft beer. You know, craft beer is really taken off in Italy.
This is from Ponte here.
It's from the village, yeah. This huge sort of booming phenomenon in Italy, craft beer. And as they are with anything that sort of requires taste and sophistication and, you know, great sort of deftness in preparing foodstuffs and drinks. The Italians are very good at making craft beer. Yeah. But Lionel, I berated you earlier for not drinking enough wine. That's the first time anyone's ever said that to you, isn't it?
Well, I do. I like a podcasting beer if we get the opportunity. This is called Malta Vivo, and it's I could see this doing really well in London. They should be shipping this over to London in boxes. And all it needs, it's got a lovely label. All it needs is a half-decent marketing campaign behind it, and I think the hipsters will be... We'll be going for that.
On the subject of food, last night's meal was the Maglia Rosa Virtuale of the Giro, wasn't it?
It really was, yeah. We were pointed in that direction by our hotelier. It must have been a good place because the crew from La Gazzetta dello Sport turned up. Yeah, and they'd also done half a page on...
Well, they were told fairly emphatically when they turned up. So this was Ciro, Luca Gialanella, some of those names, well, Ciro's name, of course, will be familiar to all listeners. But they turned up very late, about 11 o'clock. They were told in no uncertain terms the restaurant was closed, the kitchen was closed. They then produced the Day's Gazetta, opened it at the page on which they dedicated half a page to that particular restaurant and the regional specialities. And out came the red carpet.
It was a nice meal. Let me just find the name of the place. I'm sure I made a note of this.
La Rondinella,
and it was in Scalia. Well, what do we have? We had some antipasto, which was cheese and ham and artichokes in olive oil and all of that kind of stuff. Fairly standard, but very nice. And then I had...
Kikie bacala.
No, I had kikie, which was...
No, with salsiccia, with sausage.
Sausage and onion. So the pasta were small pea-sized balls. Very nice. I wondered whether there was a bit of... whether they were almost like gnocchi with potato in, but I'm not sure... I think they were just pasta, those ones. And then afterwards, we both had the salt cod bacala with chickpeas. Really was a good meal. That's in the pink jersey at the moment as far as the food goes. But let's get back to the race because as good as our meal was yesterday, well, Chris Froome had the equivalent of dropping his dinner on the floor, didn't he, a couple of kilometres from the top of the climb. Coming around that right-hand bend, it was wet. The roads are greasy because obviously it's dry down here a lot of the time. And the roads, I mean, it was a good surface, but dust gets on it. And then when the rain falls, it makes it almost like a slippery surface. And he was on the white line. A lot of other riders were riding around the corner in the middle of the road on the white line. But Froome, I don't know what it is. He just, everything just went from under him. Has he got a high centre of gravity or something? I don't know what it is.
I mean, I think he's in a run of luck at the moment, which is maybe similar to Mark Cavendish's this spring. Nothing seems to be going for him. I think he's really still suffering to a certain extent from the crash that that happened in the Recce in Israel last week. In fact, I was speaking to people at Sky this morning and they said that crash was probably worse than he or they realised at the time, and it's taken him a good week, and they sort of are still slightly nervous about, you know, his form could go either way from here as he recovers from that crash. He could either keep getting better or he could really struggle to find his best form.
The thing is, he's fallen on the same side again, hasn't he? I know it's a smaller, perhaps a lighter impact crash because it wasn't as quite high speed going uphill. But to fall on the same side, just as you're kind of getting over the last week's crash, that won't have pleased him. And when they came back down to the buses at the bottom of the climb, having descended in the cold and the damp, there weren't many smiles or happy-looking faces at the Sky bus, were there?
No, there were three or four of us there waiting to speak, hopefully, to Froome and Nicolas Portal, the director sportif. And, yeah, they weren't in talkative mood. In fact, they didn't want to talk at all. And I think... almost more worrying than the crash itself for Sky and Froome will be the fact that in that kind of rush, the sort of stampede in the last 500 metres, gaps almost opened up, but the majority of the general classification contenders were at the pointy end of the group that came in together. Froome was sort of among the stragglers to a certain extent, and, you know, we've seen this many times before, and we've seen it a lot this week, that he takes a while to sort of, when the pace goes up, he sort of takes a while to really find his rhythm. And, you know, this kind of, he always kind of accelerates on a 3 or 4 second delay, and, you know, that might be why he came in a bit behind the others, but he didn't look too sprightly, and he needs to find his climbing legs quickly, because I think tomorrow is going to be a much stiffer challenge.
Well, we'll talk about tomorrow in the final part of the podcast, but I read the race exactly the same as you do, Daniel. We see every year in the Grand Tours, in the first week and the first uphill stages, the guys that are on their toes, so to speak, Thibaut Pinot, Simon Yates today, you know, looking eager to get over the line as quickly as possible. There are time bonuses on the line, and every little bit might help.
Thibaut Pinot has to be on his toes, because one of his top domestiques is affiliated with the Calabrian Mafia.
We discussed
last night.
I'm looking both ways here. We're out of Calabria, but we need to be careful.
Steve is still in the race. We do need to be careful, because there was a lot of interest in that story today, Lionel, from our colleagues, and I felt very guilty, because I've really opened a sort of a viper's nest, and I think there might have been a queue outside the Groupama FDJ bus this morning of journalists, not just journalists who had been on the race, but crime reporters.
Oh my word. So suddenly the Groupama press officer is fielding requests for an interview with Steve Marabito. Extraordinary stuff. But it was an interesting stage from that respect. You watch the riders come over the line and see who looks good and who looks less good. And I completely agree with you. You know, if you're looking at Chris Froome for just that little bit of a sign of how well he's going, and you know, obviously he'd fallen off not 5 minutes before, so he's obviously recovering from that. It's damage limitation, get over the line as quickly as possible. But like you say, everything goes right for the people who win Grand Tours, and everything goes wrong for the people who don't. And at the moment, Froome is in the latter camp, isn't he?
A San Francisco. A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Well, Rafa make the wonderful Pedaleur de Charme t-shirts, which you can buy on the rafa.cc website, or if you want to go to our website, thecyclingpodcast.com/shop. That will take you straight there, and you can see the jersey, the cap, the t-shirts in the Pedaleur de Charme and Pedaleurs de Charme range. We opened up the public vote yesterday, and Jack Haig, well, he rode today like someone who was expecting to win the Pedaleur de Charme prize, and he has done so with a commanding 48%. I'm going to resist a Brexit joke here. 48% won on this occasion. Enough for a victory on this occasion for Jack Haig. So I will go and find him tomorrow and present him with his Pedaleur de Charme jersey. What are we doing?
I want to show you something, Lionel.
But this isn't anywhere near the Giro.
Oh no, we're off the route, but get out the car.
But it's raining.
Get out.
Oh, I don't like... I don't...
Handbrake on.
Yeah. I don't like in charge, Daniel.
I brought you, Lionel, to the Zonkerland.
Oh, no, even I know this isn't the Zonkerland.
It's the Zonkerland of the South. We're at the foot. We're in a place called Calvanico. This is, well, the climb that we can see in front of us that you're about to describe, the mountain you're about to describe, is where the Zonkerland of the South begins its journey.
I would describe it, but it's shrouded in cloud at the moment. How much higher does it go than there? I mean, it looks quite mountainous, but it doesn't look as impressive as mountains in the north, I wouldn't say.
We're in the Monte Picentini, so we're just to the east of Salerno, not far from Naples. And, the climb we're talking about goes up to just over 1,000 metres above sea level.
Well, it's nothing like the Zonkerland then, is it?
Well, it's nothing like the Zonkerland, but it's also nothing like what was advertised, mythologised, speculated about. In 2011, there were a series of newspaper reports. The story was broken on an internet newspaper called Infoggi, but then it subsequently went on to appear in Tutto Sport, in various cycling magazines, Il Mattino, a local newspaper, that the 2012 Giro was going to feature the Zonkerland of the South, and that was the Rifugio Calvanico. The problem was that the climb they were talking about was 7.8 kilometres long, 13% average. It was going to be the hardest climb ever to feature in a Grand Tour. However, it didn't exist. Or it didn't exist in the form that people thought existed in. It existed in. There was a Facebook group started. There were letters sent to the local mayor of Calvanico. There was a mischievous grin from the then Giro boss Angelo Zomagnan when the Rifugio Calvanico and the Zoncolan of the South was mentioned, and everyone was ready for it to be unveiled at the 2012 Giro route presentation, but it wasn't. I actually came up here not long after that to try and investigate. I was writing a book called Mountain High. I wanted to know what this Rifugio Calvanico was. I spent about a day here asking for directions, asking people what this climb was, where it was, and it turned out it didn't really exist. Something vaguely similar existed. It was a climb to a santuario, a religious sanctuary of San Michele, Pizzo di San Michele, but it was not as high as people thought it was. It was not quite as steep, and it was in no condition to host even a village kermesse, let alone the Giro d'Italia.
So let me get this straight. It's not an average percentage of 13%. It's not 7.8.
It was 11%. And I actually did climb it on a bike, but it was about 7 kilometres long, 11% average. But it's never going to appear in the Giro.
So did we get to the bottom of why this story even existed? Was it some kind of internet myth or somebody, a bit like when people post completely made up transfer rumours on football forums and then it appears in the Sun and it turns out that the player doesn't even exist? Is it
correct?
Similar
it was
to that?
Exactly that. It was an internet-based whispering campaign. Mauro Vegni, who is now the Giro boss but was then the Giro route director, I spoke to him about the Rifugio Calvanico and the Zoncolan in the South, and he says that there are 60 million people in Italy and 60 million people who want to design a Giro route. They all think it's like they all want to be the Italian football team manager. They all think they know the best team. He says he gets thousands of suggestions for climbs to use, and dozens of people have claimed that they've found the Zoncolan of the South or the East of the West, and that was one of it was a case like that.
I imagine whoever invented this mountain and started this story probably felt quite satisfied when it pitched up in national newspapers and magazines. I know,
and a book, and four pages were dedicated to it in a book called Mountain Higher.
Yeah, but you were debunking the myth rather than going along with it. I mean, it's something the Cycling Podcast tried years ago when starting the rumour that Geraint Thomas was going to join BMC.
We've started lots of those rumours.
Covering the Giro with you, Daniel, it's a magical mystery tour. I never quite know what's happening. You just said, "Oh, we'll just take a little deviation." I didn't really know what was going on, and I came out of it having learned something. Although I had a recollection of that, having read it in your book a few years ago. But I wasn't aware of exactly where the fake Zoncolan was.
Well, actually, when we came off the Montevergine di Mercogliano climb today, we came down a different side.
Stumbled a bit there, didn't you, on the pronunciation?
Yeah, almost. we came down a way that intersects with the race route about two-thirds of the way up, and it was very steep actually, and it made me wonder why the Giro organisation has not used that road before, and it was in pretty decent condition. So
very narrow though, wasn't it?
But it was quite narrow, but you know, there are a lot of climbs in this part of the world. It's very mountainous. This is the Apennines, Lionel, but you know, there are sub-ranges of the Apennines. We were in one today, the Monte Picentini. The Giro organisation over the years has tended to be in the south in the first part of the race, and they've wanted a fairly sort of gentle summit finish or a gentle mountain stage as the first mountain stage. So we've been to Montevergine in Mercogliano a few times, and Monte Sirino, climbs like that. But it would be nice to see something really gnarly and nasty in the south of Italy. And I think, you know, the fans would really get excited about that. As we saw, I mean, there was tens of thousands of signatures in this campaign to have the so-called Zoncolan of the Sud included. Of the South.
I do love this idea of fans creating a news story, getting it in the papers and getting a sense of legitimacy before, you know, anyone's had a chance to check out whether the climb actually existed.
Well,
it's amazing, really.
I've noticed that in the Vuelta in particular, there's a fantastic community of sort of forum posters. What do you call people who post on forums?
Forum posters.
Forum posters.
People.
People. Internet people. Remember, forum people, as Mark Cavendish used to call them, that post online. There are various, I can't remember all their names, but who post on forums, particularly in Spain, suggesting climbs. And some of them, I had to trawl these forums when writing my books about mountains. Some of them have ended up in the Vuelta, and there have been some real gems that have been discovered purely by punters, fans.
Local cyclists who know that there's an absolute beast of a climb somewhere that would be great in a bike race. But on a similar vein, I'm going to try and popularise a nickname I've come up with for Simon Yates, Berry-born Simon Yates. Now, if you are interested in food, as I am, as everyone knows after the last couple of days, I'm partial to a bit of black pudding. Or boudin noir, as they call it in France. They have a version in Spain as well. It's for those who don't know, perhaps listening further afield, who don't have this delight, this delicacy. It's made from pig's blood and fat. It's a sausage. A black pudding is a sausage.
What do you make of Il Corriere della Sera saying today that Thibaut Pinot was as rich as a recipe for foie gras? I didn't get that at all.
No, well. No, but I'm gonna make this nickname. I'm gonna get this in Gazetta somehow or one of the other papers by the end. Simon Yates is from Bury, of course. I'm not sure he eats an awful lot of black pudding by the looks of him. I don't think there's a great deal of body fat on him. He probably doesn't sit down to too many plates of it. But the Italian version of black pudding is called sanguinaccio. So I'm going to start calling Simon Yates Sanguinaccio Volante, the flying black pudding, and see if we can get that into popular parlance in the Italian press. What do you think my chances are? Do you think do the Italians go for that kind of thing? They're the king of the nicknames, aren't they?
Oh, they absolutely love a nickname.
I think we'd get it going. Let's mention it to Ciro. Sanguinaccio Volante, the flying black pudding.
Yeah, I think Ciro will go for that. Ciro was incredibly excited. The fact that Simon Yates and Adam Yates were big aficionados and lovers of Indian food got Ciro very, very excited this morning. I guarantee that will be in the Gazetta tomorrow.
He probably wants to come to our events at the end of the year and sample some of the curries that the Yates brothers themselves enjoy.
Well, we should point out, Lionel, that our 10 facts ended up being, well, and it was 8 facts in the end about Simon Yates, wasn't it? That was really inspired by us noticing how much La Gazzetta and the Italian press are struggling for information about Simon Yates and struggling for colour. So much so that La Gazzetta listed, well, the best thing they could come up with yesterday, or when did he take the pink jersey? Was it yesterday?
A couple of days ago,
was that he liked watching TV.
Yeah, it reminds me of those football magazines in the 80s when I was growing up doing interviews with the players, the question and answers, you know, hobbies, you know, reading, driving, watching TV. I mean, yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? They are quite opaque in that sense. They don't give a lot away on or off the bike, really. I mean, that's part of...
Likes video games as well.
Right, well, you know, I mean...
Don't know which one.
Well, maybe we should make that our mission to find out. But I think there's something in that. They're not showy, are they, in that sense? And I think, we will find out a lot more about Simon Yates as the race goes on, particularly if he keeps the pink jersey. But Daniel, this morning, did you speak to anybody else?
I did. George Bennett. Always a pleasure to speak to George Bennett. Certainly one of the more expansive riders in the peloton at the moment. And he's had a very good first week of the Giro. He's riding high on general classification. Lionel, do you have the general classification
there?
Can you tell me exactly where he is on general classification?
Oh, no, I've just closed it.
He's ninth on general classification.
He is, because I think he's gone down a place as a result of Carapaz.
Oh, well, in that case, he'll be 10th. Yeah. He'll be 10th. However, he's looked like one of the best climbers in the race. He's looked, over the past year, to be one of the best climbers in the world. And, you know, it's quite exciting to just observe from afar this sort of journey of self-discovery that he seems to be on. And I sort of asked him about that course that he's on and that trajectory this morning.
And in the last sort of 12 months, 18 months, you really seem to have kind of entered a different dimension as a rider. Are you sort of gaining confidence with every mountain stage, really, that you're doing at the moment?
So far, it's been really good. I mean, this year's been super consistent, always top 10, and people keep asking me if I'm surprised or something, but actually not anymore. You know, after the Vuelta when I was 10th, I think last year was another big step up, and the Tour especially, but had a bit of bad luck getting sick the last half of the year. But I mean, this year's been another, I like to think, another step up, but it's hard to know, you know, because like you can't compare numbers with numbers because it was different climbs, it was different leading to the climbs. But if I look just at the results, I think, you know, I feel like I'm there and competitive and not really happy with 10th place anymore.
With most guys, they have a set of expectations, and then the staff and their team have a set of expectations for them, and often they don't match up. Either the rider thinks he's better than they think he is, or the other way around. How is it in your case?
I really think this team has a lot of faith in me. They really believe in me, and you know, sometimes I think I'm better than I am, and other times they think I'm better than I am, or you know, better than I think I am. It works well because they keep me in check, but they also give me a lot of confidence and put a team behind me. And the thing is, the expectations, I don't really actually care that much about if it goes wrong. I mean, I do. I'm really disappointed for myself, but I do it for myself and for my friends and my family and things like that. And it's not that I feel this pressure that I have to do it because the director of Lotto Jumbo, you know, it's more an internal sort of thing as opposed to external pressure.
You're lucky to have that mentality. Not every guy does.
I think for sure. And you see it in the way some guys ride, you know, when the team's giving them heat in the press and all that stuff. It's never a good thing. And yeah, if it doesn't work out, I mean, what can you do? You know, it's a bike race.
He's always great value, isn't he, George Bennett? Always got something interesting to say. One dynamite quote in the episode from Mount Etna when I spoke to him that morning. Go back and listen to that if you missed it. But we were following the Team Lotto NL Jumbo bus yesterday, weren't we, as we were driving up the course. And they've got the names of the riders all on the back, as all the buses do. They have all the names of the riders on the bus. And it's struggled to get a handle on what that team actually is. I mean, it's Dutch at its heart, but it's got some quite interesting foreign riders, and you wonder, they're split a little bit here with Van Poppel sprinting, but they're off to an absolute flyer, really, with Batelin winning the stage a few days ago, and Bennett in the top 10 and climbing well and looking very good on Etna. And today, Bauman riding extremely well out of the break, and kind of, he had a half a chance at the end. It just faded at the crucial point, but they're a team that are punching above their weight here and tend to do so. I mean, bag more wins than perhaps you would think from the riders that they've got on their roster.
So our question this week for Science and Sport is from Chris Holyfield in North Wales. Hi guys, love the podcast. Thanks, Chris. I'll not read the rest of that because it's a bit flattering. I have a question for Science and Sport. As a larger rider who wants to shift a fair few pounds, what's the best way to lose weight but still stay fueled on a ride? Is there a form of nutrition that particularly suits this?
A negative energy balance is essential to shifting weight. You can achieve this by burning more calories in training or consuming fewer calories in the form of food. A bit of both normally works well, so you need to do some long rides, probably 2 or 3 hours long, will help you burn quite a lot of calories, especially fat. And then some short, intense sessions, even 30 minutes of intervals, will produce a high calorie burn during the ride and also a sustained calorie burn after the ride because your metabolic rate will be increased. If you delay your fueling for the first hour of your ride, it'll help generate a negative energy balance. You'll still need to take on board some carbs though, because if you don't take any fuel on board during the ride, the intensity will drop and the calorie burn will go down. So the ideal things to take would be Science in Sport gel, for example, an energy bar or some Go electrolyte drink to help maintain hydration during the ride as well. Replacing some of the high GI carbohydrates with vegetables. So if we replace, for example, the potatoes or rice or pasta you might have on your plate in the evening meal with some spinach or broccoli, then that will help you stay full without consuming too many calories.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust Science in Sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. If you want to get 25% off all Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com, and when you check out, enter the code SISCP25. That was a listener's question that was answered by one of Science in Sport's experts, and we'll be playing a few more of those as I think one a week as the Giro goes on, and then that series will continue. While I'm just doing a little bit of plugging and various other things, this is a last call for anyone who wants to call our WhatsApp number with a question for our debut show, where we'll be answering listeners' questions on the rest day.
Well, riders do press conferences on rest day, so we thought we should answer some questions as well, you know.
Yeah, well, the question came flooding in at this request. Yeah, there's a telephone number to leave us a WhatsApp message. It's WhatsApp, so if you're on Wi-Fi, it doesn't cost you anything. +44 797 133 8205. And if you go to our Twitter page at @cycling_podcast, the number is actually in our biography there as well, if you didn't catch that. Or you can just scroll back a few seconds and make a note of the number. Leave us a question about anything, our Giro coverage, or, well, yeah, it's got to stick to the Giro for now, if you can. Any aspects of our Giro coverage so far, or what might come up in the week, and we'll answer those as many as we can on Monday, and we'll put that out hopefully on Monday evening. Also, Friends of the Podcast episodes that you can listen to. Kilometre Zero is for Friends of the Podcast at this Giro. If you want to sign up and listen to those, it's thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. It's £15 to sign up for 2018, and you'll get loads of episodes. Kilometre Zero, we've done three so far, one on the start in Israel, then one looking at Sicily, and what was Friday's one, Daniel? I've forgotten already.
Sorry, Lionel, I was distracted there.
Kilometre Zero on Friday.
Friday was the Little Fish.
The Little Fish.
The Pesciolino.
Of course, yeah. Find out who's the Little Fish. You might be able to guess that if you haven't listened already. And we've got another Kilometre Zero coming up on Monday. Another Friends of the Podcast episode that came out at the start of the year was Lunch with Matt White, the Mitchelton Scott sports director. You probably heard a little bit of about him on this podcast during the Giro, because of course he is the boss of Simon Yates's team. Always good value, always has something interesting to say. Fascinating lunch. He talks about his own experiences riding the Giro back in the kind of Wild West days. And lastly, don't forget that there's a chance to win some Rafa and Science in Sport swag by retweeting tonight's episode. Just go on to our Twitter page at @cycling_podcast, retweet and add a short comment stating why you listen to the Cycling Podcast. Use the hashtag Giro101. Our first winner was at @beardo_l, who's won a limited edition Rafa Gavia hat styled on the iconic piece worn by Andy Hampston, who basically won the Giro in 1988 by riding very well in the snow on the Gavia. You can find the full Gavia collection on Rafa's website. We'll announce more winners on the next rest day, and you can enter as many times as you want throughout the Giro. I mean, can't say fairer than that. Just join in and win some stuff. Now, this morning, Daniel, I went to the Katusha bus to talk to the British rider Alex Dowsett, I think riding the Giro for the first time since 2013, when, of course, he won that huge 60-kilometre...
We don't want mistakes, Lionel, in tonight's episode. I don't want to be sitting here with you tomorrow having to make corrections.
Alex Dowsett did ride the 2013 Giro because he won that time trial stage, didn't he? Upset the apple cart when Bradley Wiggins was going to go and win the Giro coming off the back of the Tour de France. I'm actually just double checking that.
Look it up, Lionel.
He hasn't ridden the Giro.
Check again.
Hasn't ridden the Giro since. So he's riding the Giro for the first time since 2013. Anyway, last night after the stage finish in Praia Amare, he tweeted his dissatisfaction. And as I just say that, the floodlight in our courtyard here has just come on, as if it's listening to us. But he tweeted about the danger posed by the unlit tunnel or tunnels on the run-in. And the one that caused particular consternation was with around 7 kilometres to go, when the race was really on. It was kind of slightly downhill as well, on the run-in to the finish on the seafront. And, well, this is what he said about the danger and difficulty that tunnel posed. Alex, can you describe your experience riding through the tunnels yesterday? Because you tweeted something to say that it's not really on to have unlit tunnels so close to the finish.
Yeah, it's frightening. It's possibly the most scared I've been on a bike. I certainly wasn't the only one. I mean, anyone that's a cyclist, just imagine riding in a group and then shutting your eyes for 15 seconds on the wheel of someone in front of you. Just, you can't see a thing. You don't know what anyone else around you is doing. It just shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have been in the race. Imagine just switching the lights off in a Formula One race.
Was it completely dark in there? Or was it lit in any way?
There's about 4 candles. There's a couple of like token flames at the side of the road, but yeah, couldn't see a thing. Could not see anything.
You've raced in Italy a lot before. The Giro is known, I guess. Racing in Italy, they do have unlit tunnels. It's the issue that it was so close to the finish when the race is really on.
I think there just shouldn't be unlit tunnels generally on a course. We don't have lights. On a climb, it's perhaps talking about a question of risk here. risking ourselves all the time when we're racing. At the end of the day, we have a helmet, and that's all we have to protect ourselves, and we're reaching speeds of 40-50 mile an hour. But if there's any stretches that can be made to make our environment as safe as possible, then they need to be taken, and yesterday was just careless.
And lastly on that, what was it like actually in that tunnel? Was there shouting? You know, I mean, what can you do to try and make sure you don't hit the rider in front of you?
I don't think there was any shouting. I think everyone was possibly in the same boat. For me personally, all I did was I quickly thought that if I was to brake, someone would hit me from behind. I certainly didn't want to accelerate in case someone in front of me was braking. Just tried to stay in a straight line. Tried not to make any sort of movements left, right, forwards or backward, and in the hope that everyone else sort of did the same. I still had that half a mind I had on the race kind of went out the window for that tunnel. Probably the same case with everyone. And the amount of risk that we have to take at times, and you know, the organisers that put these races on and try and sometimes make it as epic as possible, sometimes at the expense of us. And times like that, we look out for each other. Unfortunately, what's it going to take? Would it have been better yesterday if someone had had a huge crash and they really injured themselves for the organisers to actually take notice? We get an apology afterwards and it's like, oh, sorry. It's like, well, what's to stop that happening again? What's to stop? We've got tunnels today. Are they going to put floodlights in there? Or are they just going to put 8 candles instead of 4?
Well, Daniel, I think you can hear in Alex Dowsett's voice not just the frustration, but kind of controlled anger about the situation the riders were put in yesterday. Should make clear, Dowsett wasn't the only person to tweet something or be unhappy about the position the riders were put in. I did try to suggest, was it more troubling because it came at a point of the race where everybody was, you know, trying to move up and, you know, so close to the finish? And he made the valid point that really an unlit tunnel or a very badly lit tunnel has no place in the race. And I think it's, you know, it's something that we see not just in Italy, but we do see in other countries. Races go through tunnels that are poorly lit, and the riders have to take, you know, have to basically hold their breath and hope for the best.
And we remarked, didn't we, in the car on the journey today, Lionel, that this Giro d'Italia so far has had a slightly retro feel about it, in the sense that if you go back and read newspaper reports or books about the Giros of the 60s and 70s, you know, there was all sorts of kind of skullduggery, intrigue, shambolic organisation. And, you know, between the transfer from Israel to Sicily and then the boat trips that we heard about yesterday, and then yesterday, for example, on the stage to Praia Mare, about 20 kilometres from the finish, the peloton went through a town called Diamante, Diamond, and while everyone was out of their houses at the roadside watching the Giro go past, two armed robbers were smashing their way into the post office in Diamante and stealing €14,000. Then we've got Steve Morabito's Calabrian mafia connections. It's a bit of a shock in an age when the Giro over the past few years has become, I mean, it's retained most of its charm, but it's becoming more and more sort of sanitized, more international, more sort of polished, certainly in a way that it wasn't 15 or 20 years ago. But
I would say the image is polished, but the reality when you get up close, I mean, it is fairly shambolic. You know, the starts and the finishes, you know, the signposting for, you know, the race vehicles is not necessarily the best. And remember, the team buses and so on have to follow those directions. Yeah, quite a shambles at the parking this morning at the start. But unlit tunnels when riders are hitting 50 miles an hour or 75, 80 kilometres an hour, I mean, really, that is a fairly simple one to solve, isn't it? Some generators and some floodlights. I mean, it can't be difficult. It's kind of a symbol of almost neglect, really. And I don't think it is acceptable. I don't think it's on, really. You know, when we were in Sicily, and the country is gradually improving as we move further north, but there's definitely a sense that the south has been forgotten. And it did make me think, when we drove up Mount Etna, the way we went up, the road surface has been improved. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of euros that would have cost to resurface that road. But,
well, Lionel, some of the press buffets, I think the budget for some of our press buffets in Sicily dwarfed what some of the local councils have spent on their roads and so forth in the last year. I mean, these opulent banquets that we've been treated to.
But the thing is, with, you know, I don't want to be kind of flippant about it, but the race needs good road surfaces, of course. But does Mount Etna need a good road surface for the general population? And it's that balance of bringing the race to a region to show off that region. But what is going to be the long-term effects? And I suppose that's one of the things about sport in the 21st century, the disparity between the money that is available at the very, very top for the athletes. And when you think of the money that the riders are being offered to take part, and if my information is correct, you know, seven figures for Team Sky / Chris Froome. I'm not quite sure how that breaks down, but that's a lot of money to attract them to the start. I believe Nairo Quintana was paid a similar amount last year to come. You know, so money is available. And then when it comes to the actual race itself, it doesn't seem to be available, or at least if the money is available, it's not being spent in the right place. But, you know, that's something. I think Alex's point at the very end there was, you know, they get every time this happens, they get an apology and are sorry. And then what happens? Nothing, really. The same thing happens again the next time they go through a tunnel. But there we go. That's maybe something for the riders union to pick up at and take to the UCI.
Tomorrow we're going to Gran Sasso d'Italia. Impromptu Italian lesson. What does Gran Sasso mean? Any ideas?
Big rock. Big rock.
The big rock of Italy. We've been up there a few times with the Giro, famously in 1999. Marco Pantani won in the snow.
Is it a big table-shaped rock?
It kind of looks like a bit of an anvil. Do you know what an anvil looks like?
Yeah.
Very spectacular. They call it, there's a huge plateau at the top, very beautiful, where the race finishes tomorrow, that they call, it's known as the Piccolo Tibet, the small Tibet, because it looks like high plateaus in Tibet, I'm led to believe. However, the most important event in the history of the Gran Sasso d'Italia and Campo Imperatore, where we finished yesterday, was the liberation of Mussolini. Do you know what happened?
I don't.
So Mussolini was arrested, obviously towards the back end of the Second World War, in July 1943. Adolf Hitler, not a friend of the podcast.
I'd have to check all the email addresses.
he began plotting to liberate his fellow fascist, Benito Mussolini. Didn't know where he was. One of Hitler's secret agents located Mussolini in Sardinia, tried to rescue him there, didn't work. Mussolini was then moved, and messages were intercepted over the airways, and he was located at Campo Imperatore, where we're finishing tomorrow. Hitler dispatched one of his top SS Luftwaffe pilots, Otto Skorzeny, to Campo Imperatore, landed, freed Mussolini, and took him back to Berlin via Rome, I think.
How does that relate to the bike race?
Well, it doesn't relate to the bike race.
What do we expect on Gran Sasso?
Well, I don't really expect anyone to be liberated and taken back to Berlin. Maybe I'll be liberated from the Giro and taken back home to Berlin. What do we expect from the Giro? It's a very long climb. Have we got the Garibaldi in front of us? Why haven't we got the Garibaldi?
I left it in the toilet. If you listen to the Kilometre Zero a few days ago,
the significant portion of the Gran Sasso d'Italia climb, the Campo Imperatore climb, is the last 2-3 kilometers, where the having sort of oscillated between about 4% and 6% for most of the climb, it then goes up to about 8 or 9 or 10 in places, and that's where Pantani attacked in 1999. That's where we think there'll be a bit of a GC sort out tomorrow. Giuseppe Martinelli, we mentioned him yesterday, the Astana director sportif, the most successful director sportif in recent history of the Giro. He thinks that even from 6 or 7 kilometers to go, there could be some big attacks tomorrow. So there will be changes on GC.
Interesting. So much harder than today.
Much harder than.
And it's
today.
A long stage, isn't it? It's the longest stage of the race, 2.29 or 2.39 kilometers. It's going to be it's going to be a long day. Will there be rain again? Is that what's
weather
forecast?
Weather is forecast. Rain is forecast.
Rain is forecast. Well, it's the last day before the rest day as well, and that, you know, there's always a little bit more eagerness to, knowing that there's a day to recover. We might see some action on the final climb, and we will bring that to you tomorrow evening in the cycling podcast from the Giro d'Italia. And until then,
we're off to what are we going to drink tonight? We're going to drink wine. We're going to drink Falanghina, is the famous white wine from around here. Very much acclaimed in recent years, the Falanghina produced in this specific region. But we're going to go red tonight. We're going to have some Aglianico, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to whatever they're serving. I think it's a sort of fixed menu here, isn't it? So we will go and see what it is. We'll report back and see whether it captured the Maglia Rosa Virtuelle. I mean, that's mangling. You said that. That's mangling. Virtuelle's not an Italian word.
No, I said, did you not say Maglia Rosa Virtuale?
The listeners can decide. Anyway, until tomorrow. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa. Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che l'anacquo con l'acqua non fine. Ci gira nella tenevo giardina che l'anacquo con l'acqua non fine.